Yes, this is a crime spree. This is Grandpa Dan, and this is my manifesto. Yes, I've been on a crime spree. FBI just went on high alert. Well, let me tell you about my crime spree. I have hijacked Albion Insights. Yes, this show now belongs to me. And I've also done a kidnapping. I've kidnapped Cato. If any of y'all are familiar with Dr. Slattery's program, you probably tune in on Mondays. You're familiar with Cato. I have kidnapped Cato from Dr. Slattery, drug him over here to my hijacked Albion Insight show. And that's right, I'm going to force him to sit here and have a discussion with me. It's going to be fun. It's going to be lively. FBI, you can go ahead and turn off the red alert. I'm sorry to get you so excited. Welcome, Cato. How's it going, man?
Howdy.
So, well, anybody that might not be familiar, maybe for some reason they haven't caught you on Dr. Slattery's program, just kind of give us an idea of who you are.
All right. So yes, I am Dr. Patrick Slattery's Monday co-host. For those who don't know, Dr. Slattery is Dr. David Duke's co-host on David Duke's show. But Dr. Slattery, he has his own show called National Bugle Radio. And on Mondays, he has he devotes an entire section to China and Chinese topics. And of course, I am Chinese. I am Han Chinese. So therefore, I discuss this with him. And of course, the reason why I'm called Cato is because the first show I was on was with Patrick and Jeremy, Dr. Patrick Slattery and his co-host Jeremy. And they oftentimes call themselves the dynamic duo, Batman and Robin. So therefore, since they're Batman and Robin, I said, I'll be Cato then. So that's why I'm Cato. But yes, I'm on Monday mornings with Dr. Slattery talking about China and all things China related.
Well, I didn't realize you weren't white. I'm sorry, we can't do this show. Get the hell out of here. No, we're going to make diversity our strength this week here on Radio Albion. Well, it is great to have you on. And by the way, I consider Cato a bro here. So, you know, he got the rare invite. I don't do these shows where I sit down and visit with other people very often. So it's always great to kind of knock the rust off and have a lively discussion. And you know, discussing things related to China is, I mean, obviously we've got the U.S. regime that apparently, even though the Joe Biden administration is totally owned and controlled by the Chinese, seems to be hell-bent on starting a war and conflict with China, which I don't know how people rectify that and, you know, make sense of that in their own minds. But that's the narrative that we seem to be under right now. And it is important because, you know, the average person has like zero understanding of these things. And obviously you are of Han Chinese ethnicity. So you're pretty tuned in on these things. And I think it's really great to have some insight into this sort of stuff. So, you know, that we aren't bumbling around and being ignorant, because we know that the narrative, I mean, the anti-China rhetoric, the propaganda that's being given to us right now is, I mean, we're just like half a step away from a bear and an eagle in a cage tier stuff. I mean, you would think that they're putting the Uyghurs, or however you say it, the Uyghurs into a roller coaster that goes down and slams at the end and slings them off into an oven. I mean, we're just about half a step away. In fact, I kind of expect that to start happening. So, you know, this ridiculous propaganda that we're getting, they're obviously trying to get everybody prepared for like an idea of conflict with China, which is a really bad idea in my opinion. But I do think that's kind of where these things are headed. I mean, so I think it's important to really be able to step back and get some other perspectives and, you know, basically cut through the bullshit. I mean, what do you think, Cato, about the anti-China propaganda they're ginning out? Do you think Joe Biden is just a puppet of the communist Chinese?
Well, that's the thing was early on, even before Joe Biden so-called became president, early on, even in the primaries, when all these normie conservatives were going on about, Joe Biden, he's controlled by the CCP, ha, ha, ha. I said very, very early on that Joe Biden, if he gets in at the time when he was still running, if Joe Biden gets in, Joe Biden will be by far the most anti-China president of all time. And I was right. I was 100% right that we've never seen an administration, a regime, so aggressive, so dogmatic and threatening against China. I mean, people say, well, Trump was, he had a lot of anti-China. Trump initially wasn't very anti-China. He just wanted fair trade deals with China. That was all. Of course, at the end, he kind of, you know, with his big mouth and all the neocons that he brought into the office, like that fat slob Pompeo, may have shaped that a little bit. But even then, though, Trump wasn't about starting a war with China. Joe Biden is all about starting a war with China. I mean, we've already seen how the State Department is making all these threats against China, saying that, oh, yeah, you know, you have to do something about your, you know, you're violating human rights and you're against the ethnic minorities and you're discriminating against ethnic minorities. And of course, China just doesn't stand for that and shot right back and said, no, you guys are the ones who are against your own people. Look, what about those, I mean, they didn't say it, but they said half the people who don't trust your administration, implying, you know, the half that, you know, some of the half that participated in January 6th. So China standing up saying, yeah, we're not going to just sit here and tolerate the American aggression, the American imperialism that's coming from the Biden administration. And it's never before seen. Levels of aggression against China from any administration in all of U.S. history. And yeah, I mean, as a Chinese person, obviously, I'm very angry about this, and rightly so. And you know, and there's a lot of people who are angry about this too, because if you look at the public opinion, the global public opinion on the United States, it's not very high. In fact, I remember I saw a poll a while ago that said, which entity do you think is the greatest threat to world peace? And hands down, number one threat was the United States of America. The United States is the greatest threat to world peace. And it's because of things like this. And of course, all the previous wars in the past. I mean, how many wars has China fought with other countries in the past? It's, you know, since the founding of the People's Republic, none, zero. And you look at all the wars the United States has been in. I mean, just in its less than 250-year history, only about 20 years has the United States not been at war, but the rest of those years the U.S. has been in a war of some sort. So it's definitely it's alarming, and yes, very infuriating to see this evil American empire, this global homo American empire come after my people, come after my nation.
Well, you know, you brought up the January 6th thing. I'm glad you did. You know, I think there's this misconception that has just been programmed into people's minds. There's this like false correlation people seem to have between the, because I'm pro freedom. I like the idea of freedom, but see, people have made this misconception, like they've made this false correlation between the quote unquote democracy and freedom. And they think that, you know, they think that the two terms, and I think maybe this is reflective of the fact that we live in a society, quote unquote, now. And by the way, I have to stop here and really quick point out that whenever we talk about Joe Biden and the Biden administration, I mean, we're using that in quotation marks. Everybody listening to this, everybody sitting here doing this show, both of us sitting here doing this show, we understand that Joe Biden isn't actually making any real decisions. He's just, you know, like a puppet figure. But anyway, there seems to be this false people. We live in a society where words don't have meaning anymore. People will throw out terms and you're like, wait a minute, that doesn't even mean that. And yet people will ramble on like, no, it does, because I think it does. And words don't have meaning. And maybe it's reflective of that. But people have this false sense like democracy means the same thing as freedom. Like there is this direct correlation. More democracy, the more freedom. And that's absolutely absurd. It's provably false. Now, I look at like, things, the way things are being done in China, and obviously it's very different because it's different people and they're going to have different systems that work for them. But I've had the argument for some time that I think there's more overall freedom in China than we have here. Now, you say, okay, well, what do you mean? We got the freedoms as America, buddy, let me tell you. But we're talking about actual concrete things. Okay, so how do they treat political dissidents? Well, in China, pretty much as long as you don't criticize the government, you know, or try to undermine the social order, you're pretty much good to go. We look at how political dissidents are treated here in the U.S. Just a reminder, Ricky Vaughn is still facing federal charges for posting memes back in like 2015. Federal charges, prison time for being a political dissident. We know the people from the January 6th protests are being held basically in torture conditions. They're being beaten. We know that. The media doesn't want to talk about it, but we know that's happening. Political dissidents are not exactly treated really well in this country. If you're lucky, you get out with, you know, being fired from your job and drug through the mud. But political dissidents are not treated well in this country. You could face prison time for actually speaking up against the regime. What about a free press? Well, we got a free press here. Well, the idea of a free press is that you have a free exchange of ideas, but we don't have a free press. We got the supposed democracy, but our press is lockstep in line promoting the agenda of the regime. It doesn't matter if you watch MSNBC, CNN, NBC, CBS. They're all literally telling you the exact same thing. Social media, you can't sit here and have a free exchange of ideas on social media. You just get banned to where the only ideas that are promoted on social media, which are supposedly that's the people's street corner to stand there and exchange ideas, are ideas that line up with the narrative, that line up with what the regime wants. So people have this idea like, oh, well, we have the democracy, so we have more freedom, but we don't. They don't look at the practical terms. I look at China and how, you know, they're trying to manage that. And we're going to get into that, I think, a little bit. But how they're trying to manage things and keep things lined up and going in an orderly direction. And you have this scale, because I look at like Russia, and obviously Russia's in better shape than the U.S., but yet they're doing more. I've been reading where they've started instituting more of these insane lockdowns and stuff, and I'm thinking, what's Putin doing? Well, that's because Putin doesn't really have absolute control, even though the U.S. media tries to say he's a dictator. He's not. See, they're on a sliding scale. They don't have as much of the democracy as we have in the U.S., but they still have some of the democracy. So, of course, you get some of the clown world. So, you know, I really do. I think there's a false correlation in people's mind that democracy equals freedom, when even then it flies in the face that the opposite is true.
Well, yeah, that's the thing. There's this meme that I saw where it says, yeah, you better be on the good side of the U.S. because they might just bring democracy to your doorstep with bombs and everything. I mean, basically, the democracy is anything that the U.S. empire wants. Any nation that opposes the American empire, American hegemony, is undemocratic. I mean, that's what democracy essentially has become. The United States has usurped the term and hijacked that term to make it all about the United States. You know, that's why countries like Israel and Saudi Arabia, in the eyes of the U.S., are considered democracy. Well, Saudi Arabia, they don't really mention that public, but the point is that Saudi Arabia is probably one of the most brutal regimes on earth, and yet because they're in good standing with the U.S., therefore they're okay. Whereas a country like Iran, which, you know, stands up for itself, which is nationalistic and says we want our own sovereignty, we don't want to be a part of the U.S. empire, the U.S. You know, neoliberal world order, or whatever you call it, it's you know, therefore Iran is bad. You know, nations that oppose the U.S. are undemocratic, and the nations who are with the U.S., no matter how evil and brutal they can be, are democratic. And yes, Israel too. I mean, you look at how Israel just slaughters and mass murders Palestinians, and yet they're obviously, we know, because the Jews who control the U.S. are, you know, in lockstep with the Zionist Jews in Israel, or rather in Palestine. So, yeah, essentially democracy is the tool of the U.S.
But yeah, I think there's a lack of ability to like define freedom as well in this country, because it's kind of like, you know, of course, you know me, one of my pet peeves is this, you know, God bless America. Let's pray for America. Let's pray for our leaders. You know, and it's like, why would God bless America? You know, and I'm not going to get off into one of my sermons here, but I mean, I always come back to, you know, exactly what can you point to that God would bless America for? Well, same thing with the freedom. You know, people sit there and say, well, at least here in America, we have freedom, don't we? And if you actually like drill down on people and you're like, freedom to do what? I mean, exactly. I mean, beyond gay anal and to be a tranny. I mean, those are the only things I see that are actually you could point to and say, apparently that's part of our sacred freedoms. It seems to be, they go on about Taiwan. I guess we'll get into Taiwan here in a few minutes. But, they go on about how, is the U.S. going to defend? I mean, what exactly would we be defending Taiwan to make sure they have freedom for gay anal and trannyism? I don't even understand, because people sit here and say, oh, we got the freedom, but they can't, we're here. Can you point to, tell me some freedoms that we've got, and they can't. I mean, we call it global homo, and that's what it really comes down to. You have the freedom for gay sex. You have the freedom to say your 7-year-old is transgender and put him in a dress and put him on hormone blockers. Those seem to me to be the absolute freedoms, the only absolute freedoms that we have at this time.
That too, and when it comes to freedom for other countries, yeah, gay anal, trannyism, degeneracy, and for U.S. military soldiers to have access to local women of whatever place that they occupy. That's basically what the freedom is. Freedom for U.S. soldiers to go and exploit the, Filipino women or Japanese women in these bases.
And like you just talked about Japanese bases, it's like you have these random things where usually it's a soldier of diversity will wander out from the Okinawa base and rape some girl there. And the Japanese get mad, and, the local residents get mad, and they protest. They want the U.S. out and want the U.S. bases out. And, of course, that doesn't happen. It's kind of like, I think how, we put, Joe Biden in quotation marks. Sometimes I think we need to put Japan in quotation marks, because they are an occupied country, and they talk about, and as they stir up this conflict with China, if a conflict breaks out, Japan and Korea, South Korea, are going to be right there to be the cannon fodder. And it's sad, because Japan doesn't really, if the Japanese government stood up and said, we want all these U.S. bases out of here. I don't really believe that is an option for them. I mean, it's just like the people rise up in Japan and they demand U.S. bases out. They're doing these horrible things. But nothing comes of it. They really are an occupied nation. So they really, at the end of the day, they really don't get a lot of say-so, do they?
Yeah, it ought to be called American Occupied Japan. That's what the name ought to be, American Occupied Japan, because that's what it is. Yeah, and Dr. Patrick Slattery, he spent a lot of time in Japan, actually, in the 80s and the 90s, studying, and he knows a lot of, high-ranking politicians in Japan, and he sometimes will talk about Japanese politics. And what he told me was that the one political party that actually opposes the U.S. military occupation the best is the Japan Communist Party. Is the Communist Party of Japan that's actually against these U.S. military bases, which goes into another subject, which is, okay, what exactly is communism? How do we define it? And obviously the way I see it is there are two different phases. You had the Jewish Bolshevik phase in the 1920s, the early part of the Bolshevik Revolution. That is what we in the dissident right, we as nationalists are primarily opposed to, is basically Jewish Bolshevism. But you had the second phase, after Stalin, which was, I call it the Soviet revisionist phase, which is when, starting with Stalin, but then also after really under Khrushchev, where they purged all these high-ranking Jews, whether Stalin was doing it because he really became aware of them or whether it was just for his own personal gain is besides the point. But he did purge a lot of high-ranking Jews, and that's when communism morphed into this, Soviet revisionist thing instead of a Jewish Bolshevik thing. But then you also had the you had non-Western nations rising up, and that's what communism was primarily in the latter 20th century, was non-white nations, like the People's Republic of China at the time under Mao, and Ho Chi Minh in Vietnam, and all these different non-Western nations rising up. And that's what communism was defined as in the latter 20th century. At the time, the Jews had already they were already losing a lot of power in their creation of communism, and they were already shifting to Zionism and they always had control over, Wall Street and the Federal Reserve and the media and everything, but they were already abandoning the communist project because the Soviets were in the process of purging a lot of them from the party and kicking them out. So that's when a lot of Jews became anti-communists, rather, became neocons, the Trotskyites. who, you know, Trotsky was kicked out by Stalin and then killed by Stalin. Well, a lot of these neocons, they come from Leon Trotsky, and that's something that David Duke has talked a lot about, which is the Trotskyite connection of the neocons, to where they become, instead of becoming, you know, staying with the communist agenda because that ship has already sailed, now they've become very, you know, war hawkish, and I mean, they're basically the crown of the American empire, are what these neocons are. They become a part of this American imperialist war machine, where they go around declaring wars on any nation that's undemocratic, which means any nation that opposes the United States. So a little bit of a tangent there, but it's all tied in and connected. But that's why the Japan Communist Party, I guess back to the original point, is actually more nationalist than it is communist, because of, you know, non-Western nations rising up, that theme.
Well, it's all good because we do tangents here. Anybody that listens to my show has come to expect tangents. So, yeah, no, it's all good. Yeah, I think it is. We get hung up on terms, you know, and again, I'm big on definitions. This is one of the things that makes it hard, I think, in these political discussions, is because, like, we use a term like communism, and, you know, but things shift. And I mean, we talk about China. And you look at how, you know, well, it's the China, you know, the Chinese Communist Party, but it has as much in common with Mao as I do with Janet Yellen. I mean, it doesn't really, you know, I mean, yeah, they keep the trappings of that and they keep the structure of some of that, but I mean, it is not Marxist communism as we define. It's kind of like, I'm old enough, I remember when quote unquote liberals, you know, if it, like in the 80s, say the 1980s, you know, if you talked about liberals, you were talking about, like, you know, peacenik people, you know, kind of people that wanted peace, not war, and they were, you know, wanting more regulations against corporations and stuff. And now we're at this point here in current clown world where liberal means cutting your son's dick off. And you want war all over the world in the name of more gay anal. I mean, we use these terms and we talk about these liberals, but I mean, I'm old enough to remember, it's like, if you showed this and went back in time to the 1980s and says, hey, you're a liberal, this is what a liberal is in 2021, they'd be like, well, what? You know, I mean, there's just, you know, there's no way. And it gets hard. Because, you know, I mean, you look at Russia, they still celebrate the trappings of their victory in World War II, but the Soviet Union doesn't exist anymore, but people see them having a big parade on Red Square celebrating Victory Day over Germany, and they're like, see, there's still the Soviet Union, and it's like, well, no, they're not. They're just celebrating their heritage. They're just, you know, celebrating that that's a victory. They see it as a victory for their group. I mean, you look at China, and it's the Chinese Communist Party, but you look at the things they're doing. Now, China's economy is growing at this ungodly rate. I mean, it's just, it's almost like, when I read about it, it's like, you know, it's almost growing too fast, you know, but you look at the way they're trying to manage it, and I find it really impressive. So what sort of communistic things are they doing? Well, let's see, they're cracking down on corruption so that just because you're a member of the party, you can't line your pockets. They're passing laws to check the power of big corporations, and they have a philosophy guiding their policies, and you'll be able to correct me if I'm wrong. I don't think I am. They have a philosophy guiding these policies that for this to work, for all of this growing prosperity to work, it has to be shared with the people. Now, Americans sit there and go, oh my gosh, that's so scary. My life could be better. That's just not American. That's how brainwashed people are. If big corporations in Wall Street aren't making $250 billion a week, then that's just un-American. But no, they're passing policy. They have this guiding philosophy, pushing these policies to make sure that all of this growing prosperity is shared with all of the people. Because if the money that from all of this growth funnels into the pockets of a few oligarchs and they get filthy, filthy, filthy rich, while the guy out here doing a manual labor job, digging a trench, his life just gets shittier and shittier and shittier, that does not produce a stable society. That is not good for society. They have a driving philosophy they're promoting that for it to be a stable society, they need to make sure that the guy out there doing manual labor, digging a ditch, every year his life gets a little bit better. I mean, yeah, he's not going to get rich digging ditches. Nobody thinks that. But he ought to be able to see his life get a little better. Now that we live in clown world, the average American, they look at that concept and for some reason have this knee-jerk recoiling in horror. But once again, it wasn't always this way. When I was young, everybody had this attitude that if you work hard and really, you know, use your brain a little bit and try to make good decisions, your life will kind of almost inevitably be better next year. But life will be better next year. Nobody believes that anymore. You got the memes like my parents in their 30s and me in my 30s, you know, and because nobody has that attitude. Nobody really thinks in America that if you work hard and play by the rules, your life will be better next year than it is now. There's like this sense, this cloud of doom, this cloud of hopelessness hanging over everybody that things are not going to get better. And I just think it's nice that, you know, they're actually pushing policies there that they are trying. They see the problem and they're trying to head that off. They're trying to make sure that all of the money doesn't funnel up to like a handful of super rich billionaires and that the people share in prosperity. I find it weird that Americans will find that idea like repugnant, like how dare you make my life better? And yet that's what they're trying to do there. And again, that's as far away from Mao style communism as you could get. If you look at that, you know, I love the founding fathers. Well, that's probably as close to what the founding fathers of America probably had in mind. They would probably look, if you could bring the founding fathers back from the past and say, okay, here we are. Now take a good look at modern global homo America and look at what China's doing. Which do you think is closer to what you have in mind? I think they would say China.
Well, that's the thing. I mean, all one has to do, I mean, look at Shanghai, look at Shenzhen, look at Chongqing, all these major, very developed cities, and you see how futuristic and absolutely advanced they are. And it's like, that doesn't happen under communism. You know, China has whether you like the stock market or the concept of a stock market or not, they have a stock market. You don't have that in communist countries. The Soviet Union was always this, even during its revisionist years from the 50s onwards, it was always this bureaucratic clunker that could just economically never compete with the United States. But China's not like that. China has its own economy, its own market economy. It's what you call a planned market economy where, it's not just unhinged capitalism like what we see in the U.S., which leads to income inequality and extreme poverty. Over there, they actually have controls on their billionaires. It's like in the United States, the wealthy oligarchs, they control the U.S. government. In China, the government controls the rich. I mean, even someone as big as like Jack Ma, he's not immune from the government's laws and rules. And, you know, if he does something wrong, he'll face punishment just like everyone else would in China. It's just in the U.S., somehow people with lots of money, they can just buy off politicians to, make pass loopholes or pass regulations that makes what they do suddenly not legal. I mean, you just people in the West will make a big deal like, oh, yeah, China. They, you know, a couple of years ago, there was this scandal of something about baby formula where, the owner of the corporation that was putting out baby formula was cutting corners. And a lot of children, a lot of infants were getting sick and some were even dying from it. Well, the Chinese government stepped in. They arrested the guy and executed him. Just capital punishment like that for harming the lives of innocent children. In the U.S., you got all these big, pharmaceuticals, Pfizer and Johnson & Johnson with, forget this vaccine for a minute. I mean, even beforehand, they were already promoting drugs that were just really destroying the lives of, what about the Sackler family, Oxycontin, getting a lot of Americans addicted to that. Yet they're still, I mean, they recently just got off with a slap on the wrist and a fine. And not only that, but they have so much influence. I mean, I looked at all of the top, lobbying, donors to the U.S. government and the Pharmaceutical Association of America or something like that. The one that represents Big Pharma, they were one of the top 10, in fact, probably the top 3 donors to Washington. So and all they do is they just donate money to them and then, buy politicians to pass laws that makes what they do suddenly not legal. I mean, suddenly not illegal. Whereas in China, they actually deal with the people who cause harm to the people. In the U.S., you know, the corporations, they just have to buy off the government. And suddenly, no matter how much harm they do, it's suddenly legal. It's okay.
You kind of stole my thunder bringing up OxyContin and the Sackler family, because when you were talking about the baby formula or whatever scandal, you know, and the outcome of that in China versus here, and I'm jotting that down as you brought that up. I'm like, I'm gonna talk about OxyContin and the Sacklers, and then you stole my thunder. It's okay. It's okay. We can still roll with that. No, but it is. It really is. I mean, just a. It really highlights the fact that they did. They settled a class action suit. So basically, they made I don't know how many billions off of OxyContin, and they're getting off with, you know. And people hear these numbers like, my gosh, they're having to pay a lot of money. No, they're not. It's a small percentage of what they made. No criminal prosecution. And as the way a civil a class action suit goes, anybody that knows anything about these things, I mean, you get nothing. I mean, it's like you've ever gotten the thing in the mail, and everybody at some point you'll get this thing in the mail, and due to a class action lawsuit, AT&T or somebody, I just pulled AT&T out of the air, but you know, AT&T is being forced to pay $500 million. You could have a claim in this class action lawsuit. Send this deal back in, and you send the deal back in, and you're like, $550 million. I want a piece of that action, and then you actually get a check. And I've been there. I've done this. I got one of those things. I filled it out. Hell, you know, mail it back in, and then you get a check. Here's your part. You're giving up your rights to make any claim now. You can't, nobody else can go back in and sue. These class action suits are like blanket immunity. This is why they go for these things. It's blanket immunity because once they settle it in a class action suit, they can't be sued for it again. So you get your check for it and you get $5. $5 because your loved one, you know, died of an overdose of OxyContin and destroyed their lives. And these people are still living high. They're still rich. No criminal prosecution compared to what happens there.
Not these class action lawsuits. They're already built into the business plan of these big pharmaceutical corporations or any of these big American, you know, monopoly corporations. It's already built into their business plan. Like, they already know it's coming. So, but they don't care because they're still going to make way more profits. I mean, to them, a class action lawsuit, I mean, that's just, you know, the cost of doing business.
And you think about the vaccine thing. They have blanket immunity on that, so I don't even have to worry about that. It's all profit, because when this goes south, and it is going to go south, you can't sue them. It's like, oh, it's totally safe. Then how come you had to give them blanket immunity where they can't be sued down the road? You know, it's they've got basically what amounts to blanket immunity. You brought up the stock market a while ago and the fact that China has a stock market. And, you know, the thing is, I think that people miss is the original function of having a stock market, of what that's supposed to be, you know, in a country that isn't clown world. And it used to work this way here in this country, too, by the way. We just now we're in a different world here. But just to break down real quick for folks, I mean, the way a stock market is supposed to work, for starters, you have a stock market when you have a country that actually makes things. You see, we don't make things anymore. We decided to just become a economy based on consumerism. But when you have an economy that actually makes things, so you've got a factory and you're building widgets and you're looking at this and you're like, man, we're doing real good with our widget business. If we had enough capital, we could expand. I could build more factories. I can't raise the capital. So you offer stock in the company and you sell these stocks with the purpose of you raise all of this capital from the stock sales. And now you can build a new factory, hire more workers, build more widgets. The economy does better. You employ more people. You're able to get the capital with the sale of your stocks. And the people that buy the stocks, they get a kickback. They share in the profits of the company. There's nothing wrong with a stock market that functions the way it is supposed to function. What we have now in the U.S. with our stock market, the price of the stocks is in and of itself the whole point. It's like the ultimate gambling thing. They're not raising capital to make anything. We don't make anything here except, I don't know, drugs, I guess, and military weapons. But I mean, by and large, as an economy, we don't manufacture anything. So the stock market doesn't serve the purpose of raising capital to expand the business. The cost of the stocks, the business is making the decision because they're all gambling. They're gambling on if the stock price is going to go up, if the stock price is going to go down. That's why you have all of this convoluted financial instruments, futures, and you can short sell and you can long sell, all of this stuff, because it's just gambling. The price of the stocks themselves is the whole point. And everybody's trying to, these corporations are all trying to drive up their stock price so they can then cash out and a handful of people can get rich. It has nothing to do with raising capital. But when you look at it in a manufacturing context and the fact that, you know, if you have an economy such as China where you actually build things, well, the stock market isn't evil of itself. It does serve a purpose in that context. It's just that we no longer have that context here in the U.S.
Yeah, the U.S. is purely a consumer-based, service-based economy where nothing is being produced, which, considering how evil and aggressive the U.S. empire is, losing its, you know, as, and a lot of people are going to hate me when I say this, but the U.S. losing its industrial manufacturing base may not be such a bad thing in the whole, I mean, don't get me wrong, the people losing their jobs, that's a bad thing, but you look at the way that the American empire was able to destroy Japan during the Second World War. It was because of their industrial manufacturing base. They were able to crank out so much in so little of a time because of just the amount of resources and manpower they have. But now that they don't have that anymore, it's become a lot harder. Although with that said, though, yeah, I mean, I guess you could say the only two, the military-industrial complex and Big Pharma, are really the only two that I could think of. Although, again, without that industrial manufacturing base, I mean, the military-industrial complex is not all-powerful like a lot of people think.
Well, yeah, and this brings us kind of full circle. But before we get into that, you know, when you talk about, because people have this idea and they get this notion, they're like, well, the thing about China is, you know, we're their number one customer. And Americans have this idea stuck in their head. I've always said, and anybody that's ever worked for the public is going to sit here when I say this and nod their heads. But if I ever find the guy who came up with the slogan, the customer is always right, I'm going to stomp him right in the nuts. Because it's one of the things that makes people annoying in the public sector. You know, people have to work for the public. You get this guy and he's being a real asshole and he's completely wrong. But the customer's always right. And it just, but Americans have this idea. And so they think that, well, it doesn't matter how belligerent and how aggressive the U.S. acts towards China, because China's got to sell their stuff to us. But they don't. They don't have to sell their stuff. Talking about the way they're managing their economy and talking about in the context of this false notion that China has to sell the quote unquote sell their stuff to us because, you know, the rest of the planet doesn't exist, just the U.S. I read a deal recently that China was actually they instituted tariffs, export tariffs. Let that soak in, because here in the U.S., when you talk about tariffs, everybody says import because we don't make anything. We're just talking about bringing stuff in. But they're instituting export tariffs on their steel. Why? Well, because their economy is growing so fast, the government looks at this and says, well, we need that steel here. We don't want our steel manufacturers, you know, selling it overseas just so they can make a little more money. We need the steel here for our domestic use. So they put a tariff on it to try to keep more of that steel here. And we see some of that reflected here. It's getting more and more difficult. The cost of metal in America is going up. It's going up all the time. And one of the reasons that nobody talks about, because people just listen to the mainstream media so often, but they've put export tariffs. Well, why are they putting export tariffs? Because their economy is growing at this like retarded rate that is just like a wet dream for anybody else. So they're actually able to also, yes, they sell to the rest of the world, but they also have domestic consumption because they have a real economy that's actually growing, something that sadly has become so foreign to us. You made a point right there, Cato, that, you know, how military strength, this is just an absolute truth. You could take it to the bank. Military strength, there is a direct correlation with your ability to manufacture things. You look at the Second World War. In so many aspects, both Japan and Germany, they had superior, say, airplanes. You know, especially at the onset of the war. You know, not so much towards the end of the war, but at the onset of the war, they were so far ahead. They had just better quality planes. They had better quality equipment in a lot of ways. But it's just that the U.S., for instance, could produce more. I mean, they could produce them faster than they could shoot them out of the sky. And it just becomes overwhelmed. There is a direct correlation between being able to manufacture things. That is a real economic strength. We don't have that. We have an economy based on consumption. We have an economy based on moving money around on a computer, financial instruments, and essentially a usury pyramid scheme. There is no manufacturing capability. There is no real, like a strength, a real economy to back up. So it seems to me that the U.S. military's so-called might, a lot of that, I think is a bluff, and it's a dangerous bluff. And we're fixing to get into that, I think, here in a minute. I can just picture it in my mind where I'm going to go with this. But I think it's a dangerous bluff. And I think this is gets back full circle to the opening of the program when I was talking about. This is why I think it's understanding it's important for people to get like an ethnic Chinese perspective and really a better understanding of these things, because we're stuck on this clown show. We're stuck in the clown car. They're driving us over the cliff. And you know, we need to understand, you know, not just why, but the fact that this is actually happening and why it's not going to turn out very well. They're bumbling into a war with China. I don't know if that's going to take place or not, whether it's China and Russia. Both those countries, China and Russia, have shown the patience of Job in trying to avoid a conflict. But it's like the more patience they show, the more the U.S. seems bound and determined to get into a conflict. And I would say it's a conflict they can't win. But before we get off into that, whenever I do a show like this, I have to fight my urge to monologue, because I just do shows by myself all the time. So before I get off into a monologue, I'll kick it back to you. What do you think? I mean, you've got this lack of being able to back up your military with production, and the fact that the U.S. seems bound and determined for whatever reasons to get off into a war with China and Russia.
Well, that's the thing too. It's the U.S. empire. It's overstretching itself. You could say it's eating more than it could swallow, and you know, we talk about, the military-industrial complex. Okay, the weapons and the armaments are produced still in the U.S., but that's just the final product. That is, but they need resources. Where do all these resources, these raw materials, where do they come from? They come from overseas, a lot of times China. And, that's why China is already saying we're not going to sell anymore to the U.S. because if we sell more and more, I mean, we're selling to the enemy, basically. We're selling it to the U.S. empire for them to use against us in the future for their military. So we're not going to sell any more to the U.S. And I think a lot of them are thinking in that direction. So the military industrial complex, they would be nothing if it weren't for all these raw materials and resources coming from overseas. And I think that's about to come to an end really quick. And we can already see it starting to come to an end. Like you mentioned, the tariffs, export tariffs on steel. And which, you know, goes to show you that, yeah, again, China is not this, you know, communist state, because they do allow certain companies and corporations to export. But we see them putting these tariffs on to say, yeah, don't sell to the U.S. anymore. And not to mention, you know, China has the One Belt and Road Initiative project, where it's, you know, tens of thousands of miles of railroads across Eurasia. And a lot of that, they're using the steel for that. So it's definitely coming to an end. And then I guess to transition into the topic about the military, well, I want to say this about China's current military, the People's Liberation Army. China's People's Liberation Army has never lost a single battle or never lost a single war in all of its history since 1949 to today. You look at the Chinese Civil War. Obviously, they, you know, beat Kuomintang, the nationalist Chiang Kai-shek, and forced them to retreat to Taiwan, which is called the Republic of China officially, not the People's Republic of China, the Republic of China. So you had that, and then you had the Korean conflict in the 1950s. You know, the U.S. say, "Oh yeah, it's like no, the Americans didn't win. If anything, it was more of a stalemate." And from the Chinese perspective, the Chinese gained more ground than they lost. Because you look at phase one was, you know, North Korea attacked South Korea. Phase two, the U.S. military comes in and pushes North Korea all the way back across the Yalu River into China. Phase three is Chinese People's Liberation Army, or the People's Volunteer Army, comes down and pushes the U.S. all the way back to the 38th parallel, where they draw the line. So the Chinese won that conflict. And then you also had the Sino-Indian War in the 60s where, yeah, it was no match. I mean, China beat India in like 1 week and nearly took their capital. I mean, India's capital, until they said, we're not going to do this. And then they retreated. And then you had the Sino-Vietnam War where China, also the People's Liberation Army, also blocked Vietnam from taking over Southeast Asia. So you look at all these so-called wars, which, you know, have been defensive, not offensive. And China has the People's Liberation Army. They've never lost a single war in that regard.
Well, I was thinking of a story that got relayed to me at one time earlier in my life. And the story is relayed by a guy who fought, an American who fought in the Korean War. And that kind of lines up with what you're saying. He said, you know, he got in early. And he said, while they were fighting the Koreans, he said it was so bad. I mean, he said it was so easy. I mean, he said he almost felt bad. You know, it was like, you know, shooting fish in a barrel, you know. And I'm not trying to insult Koreans here, but I mean, that was the story relayed to me. He said, you know, it just was so easy. I mean, they were just steamrolling over them. He said they were poorly equipped. They were poorly trained. I mean, they just rolled over the Korean fighters. But the same soldier, the same veteran said, when the Chinese got in, he said, that was a whole different story. He said, man, them guys could fight. And then things got really ugly. He said, when they were fighting the Koreans, it was all fun and games, but the fun and games ended very quickly. And we're not trying to see, you know, I'm not trying to turn this into a suck up to China show. That's not what I'm trying to do. But we do need to look at reality. I'm all about truth. I'm all about reality. And I really want everybody to be grounded in reality, because as I keep saying, at the rate they're going, and I might have a chance to touch on this here in a minute of why they're doing it, but at the rate they're going, you know, they are very capable of blundering us into a conflict that the U.S. will not win. You talked about the military-industrial complex, and people get this idea because they get these, you know, trillions of dollars, who knows how much money, because so much of, you know, some of it's off the books. And, you know, America, the most technologically advanced, but it's also corrupt. You look at this Joint Strike Fighter that they've been working on for like decades now, and the thing's still a death trap. Nobody likes the thing. I don't know how many billions and trillions of dollars has been spent on this thing, and it's still a smoking pile of shit. Nobody wants to fight this thing. And you look at China and even Russia. They spend this, like, you know, micro amount compared to what the U.S. spends on defense. But yet that money is so well spent that, like, you know, oh, well, they unveiled this new hypersonic missile. You know, it's like, oh, wow, okay. You know, they just made the entire U.S. Navy obsolete with this hypersonic missile technology. Both Russia and China have this, by the way. You know, with a fraction of the cost. A lot of this, you know, people point to that and say, man, the U.S. spends multiple times more than Russia or China on their their military. And it all goes, it's so corrupt. It's all being funneled into these pockets and not much result. You got all this money spent. And what do you got? You got ships that can't sail. You got, they came up with some stealth ship years ago. I was reading about it. They spent, I don't know how many billions of dollars on this stealth ship. And this admiral, back when the military still had some competent people in it, went and looked at the ship, and he's like, this thing is a floating coffin. In actual conflict, this thing can't even stop, like, rifle rounds. I mean, it's a piece of shit, but they spent all of this money on it. You know, it's the same thing. They spent all the money on the Joint Strike Fighter. Nobody wants to fly it. It's a death trap. It doesn't do, you know, the idea was we'll have a plane that works for all branches of the military, but it doesn't do anything well for any branch of the military. It's basically, it's a death trap. And then you look at, you know, the command structure of the military. Oh, you're just insulting our military. But we're not. We did a story a couple weeks ago, Sven Longshanks and I did, on the Friday edition of the Daily Nationalist. And we were talking about the ugly tranny that's the head of, like, the health department for the U.S. And just out of the blue, they made this person a 4-star admiral, because it turns out that department actually falls under the military. So, like, 1 week, you have this ugly tranny who is a civilian that has zero military experience, and the next week they're a 4-star admiral. A 4-star, if you're a soldier and you worked your whole life, and say you're an officer and you worked your whole life to become a colonel, and you've got 20 years in the service, you're on the slow grind in the game, and you become a colonel, and you walk along and you come up face to face with this tranny who last week was a civilian, today they're a 4-star admiral. You have to snap to attention. You have to salute. Yes, it's funny because I'm sitting here saluting and nobody can see me. You have to salute this person because they're now a 4-star admiral. It's just become a caricature. It's really become a caricature of what, you know, a military is supposed to be. And it's so laughably stupid, but it's not funny is the fact that they very likely, it's like they're trying almost to get us into a conflict with Russia and China, and I don't think it'll end well.
Yeah, that's the thing. It's trannyism is our strength. That's the motto of the U.S. military now. Trannyism is our strength.
Yeah, along with all our diversity. I think one of the things they're pushing this is because, and you see this kind of sporadic, because the plan was originally, the plan when it was devised decades ago by people who are a lot smarter than the ones that are running it now, when they got these trade deals, they gave all these trade deals to China, the idea was that, well, when they open up China's economy, it'll automatically open it up to liberalism, which, of course, by liberalism, we mean globo homo, and the Chinese social structure would change. You'd get the foot in the door to change the social structure so that when they made their push for this one world government, because back in the 90s, you know, Russia was basically, they were off the table. The Soviet Union had collapsed. The economy was just being strip mined by oligarchs. It was a non-factor. And the idea was China would open up and, you know, they wouldn't be able to stop the inflow of liberalism. And so by the time it came time to enact their wet dream of some sort of one world government, you know, everybody would be on board. Well, Putin came to power, put the oligarchs in check in Russia, and China just took the trade deals. But when it came to global homo, they were like, no, thanks. You know, we're not going to do this. So now they're at this stage that, according to their time schedule, it's time for their final push to make the reality of their wet dream of a one world government. But now you have Russia and China, and they're like, yeah, no, we're not doing that. And it has to be one world. It can't be the whole world except for Russia and China. That doesn't work. So they don't know what to do. They really don't have the capability to, like, attack them militarily and force them to go along. And, like, with China especially, Russia a little less so, they don't have the ability to stage their color revolutions successfully. So they're kind of at this impasse. They're stupid. They're not smart like the people that were running this agenda 20, 30 years ago. And so you've got this, like, ham-handed flailing about, like, oh, well, we're going to start a war with China then, but wait, no, we're not. We're going to walk that back. We're not going to start a war with China. We're not going to start a war with China. Well, yeah, let's take this one ship and try to, like, run into their waters to see what they will do or something. I don't know what the purpose of that is supposed to be. And you see this wild flailing about, but I think it comes back to the plan that at this stage of their scheduled agenda, we're supposed to be seamlessly morphing into our one world government system. And these two countries stand in the way. And that comes down to the point, I think that really brings to the point of why I think doing shows like this is important. And I applaud you, Cato, for coming on and speaking up the way you do, is we need to understand, look, this isn't about, like, sucking up to Russia. It's not about sucking up to China. These are countries run by men. They have their own problems. No system is perfect. We're not trying to, like, look like we're just kissing ass here. But you have to understand that if you don't want to live under a one world global homo government, China and Russia are the two major entities standing in the way of that. Now, you might have problems with, like, say, usually when people have problems, it's something they don't understand. But, like, say you have a problem, I don't like China's social credit score. I'm not going to get off into that. But, you know, I don't like this about it. It doesn't matter. All that should matter to you is if you don't want to live under a globo homo one world order, you understand that China and Russia are the entities standing in the way of that. You know, so that's all that should matter to people. It doesn't matter if you think that they should have gay anal in Taiwan. What should matter to you is if you don't want to live, you know, in the one world global homo order, that's the only thing standing in the way. If you took Russia and China off the table today, you would be like tomorrow, wake up in this hellhole of a global, basically a one world global tyranny of global homo. So I think that's kind of the takeaway, don't you think? That these two countries, Russia and China, and honestly, because China has less of the democracy than Russia, I think they're the stronger player in the two. But I think you do have to lump the two together because there is that cooperation there. That China and Russia, this is their important role, don't you think? That they are the entity standing in the way of this one world global homo.
Mm-hmm. Well, absolutely. And they do talk about how, yeah, we're not going to go along with this liberal hegemony. And you'll see articles, Chinese and Russian articles, talk about, you know, we need to oppose this liberal world order. They'll actually call it that. And liberalism is global homo. And China will never allow, unless, of course, it was, you know, it's not going to happen because China's strong. But what I was getting at is in the 1800s, when China was very weak, the Judeo-Western powers were able to conquer China and exploit China to the point where they had the whole population addicted on opium. To where they said that, you know, there used to be this saying around in the West where, that guy, he doesn't stand a Chinaman's chance. It's like, well, what does that mean at the time? Well, it was because the Chinese at the time were super weak, but today they are very strong. They're undoubtedly, the Chinese are the strongest nation in of the three East Asian nations, China, Japan, and South Korea. China undoubtedly is the Chinese. I'm talking about not just the size, not just the military, but the people, the men are the strongest. And you see how China is banning effeminism. They're banning all these you know, gay sissy Korean pop stars, these male pop stars. They're China's banning that, saying, no, we don't want our people becoming a bunch of sissies. We want them to be strong, masculine men ready to fight for their nation, fight for their family, for their people. So, yeah, we see that China's doing everything. And, of course, China doesn't allow feminism either. China doesn't allow, you know, women to just rebel against men and treat men like crap, like we see all too much here in the West. And there were some feminist group that was trying to form on WeChat, and China said no, they shut it down. So, and then we see China is also trying to make it so that their men, they don't get addicted to video games, because that's a huge problem in East Asia. I mean, you know, I go to Japan and I see all these arcade games. Just there's like one on every corner, almost these arcades, and just dudes just lined up ready to play. And China says no, we don't want that. That's not healthy. We want our boys to go out and get, you know, get healthy exercise. And then you see also China is banning a lot of these homeschooling curriculums, because I'm sorry, not homeschooling, private tutoring. That's what I meant to say. Private tutoring, these programs, you know, a lot of the more, I guess you could say, the wealthier families in China, they really push their children to go into these private tutoring sessions in the summer, because they want their kids to you know, go to the best and the best, which that's fine. But the problem is you push too much of that on them. That's unhealthy for the people, you know, for children not to go outside and exercise. Instead, they're sitting, you know, like the stereotypical Asian, you know, tiger parenting. They're always sitting inside, and the mom is there pointing fingers, saying that, oh, you know, you got an A-, that's not good enough, and you need to improve, and no playtime. Because, yeah, China said no, we want our young people, our elementary, you know, elementary school students, we want them to go out there and to get their exercise, to get, you know, the amount of healthiness they need to be healthy. We want them to get air instead of just sitting around and you know, inside, being forced to do this old, you know, timetables or, you know, whatever, math problems. Or so that's why they banned all of these private tutoring sessions, and also to make it so that the poorer people who can't afford private tutoring have better access to the education. So, you know, there goes back to that. We want everyone to prosper, not just a few. We want all people's livelihood to increase. And not to mention a lot of these private tutoring, especially the English classes, there's a lot of foreigners who are, let's just say, infiltrated and compromised that are doing a lot of these English classes. So China's very wary of that, too. So, yeah, everything that they're doing is in complete contrast to the global homo American imperialist degeneracy agenda.
As proof that God has a sense of humor, now we all wish we had a Chinaman's chance. It's just God has humor. I think that I always try to find things to laugh about. I always try to find some humor, you know. And of course, my program, you know, we do have a Christian specific segment, a sermon, if you would. And yet I always try to find a way to laugh in there, because I do. I think God gives us humor. I think God really, I mean, we're made in the image of God. And the fact that some of these ironies, it just shows that God sometimes he's definitely down with the lulls. Now we all wish we had a Chinaman's chance. I thought it was real, I don't know how to put it, the nerve of these people sort of thing. You were talking about when the feminists were getting banned off of Chinese social media. And you had here in America, you had these talking heads on the news, like pointing to this and, oh my gosh, how dare they? They're banning people off their social media. And it's like the rest of us who have been like perma banned for life off of virtually every social media in the U.S., you know, we're like, oh yeah, oh, the humanity, the humanity. How dare they? You know, how dare they? By the way, talking about social media, talking about the narratives, I just had to, just before we get off into anything else, I had to ask you, Cato, how's the you haven't been a victim of anti-Asian hate. Have you ever been a victim of anti-Asian hate crime? Have you noticed how that just disappeared? Remember when they were pushing the anti-Asian hate that's being sprouted? And then, like, all of a sudden, it just disappeared. We don't hear about that anymore. How are you faring with the anti-Asian hate here in white supremacy America?
Well, the good news is the area that I'm in is, let's just say, there's much less of the white supremacist blacks that are causing a lot of the attacks on Asians. The area I'm in is not an area where you see a lot of those. But at the same time, though, I mean, I am stuck in the degenerate wasteland known as the United States of America. And it just sucks that I'm not, you know, in China, back in China where I belong, where my people are thriving and happy. Instead, I'm stuck in this degenerate wasteland known as the USA, where I'm just, you know, I have a day job and try to make ends meet and pay the bills and have no sense of a future. But I guess it's safe to say I haven't been attacked by black white supremacists yet. But
That had to be the dumbest narrative. I don't know. It's like they try to top themselves with these incoherent narratives. They whipped up the anti-Asian hate crime thing. And then you had all of these, you know, like New York's police department, you know, it's like another victim. They couldn't hide the fact that virtually every one of these attacks against Asian people were being committed by the BRACs. See, I had to do my... I watch enough anime and Korean drama, like when they have to interject the English and the English, and it was the BRACs doing it. It was the BRACs doing it. And they couldn't hide that. And wasn't there like she was a Filipino or something, wrote an article in one of the newspapers or something talking about, you know, when it became undeniable, didn't they write some kind of article saying, well, yeah, it may, just because it's black people attacking Asian people, it's still the fault of white people. It's still due to white supremacy. Do you remember that?
Yeah, a lot of these libtards, or these shit libs, as you know, as they're properly called. Yeah, they just anything way, even if they have to just totally make it out of thin air, which is what they did, but anything to push their narrative, the anti-white narrative.
And then when it doesn't work, it just evaporates. You know, it was such a stupid narrative. It was funny. It's not funny because, like you say, like you pointed out, it is part of the anti-white race hate agenda and part of that narrative. But when you see them try to push something so stupid, and then they can't cover up the fact that all these Asian people being attacked are being attacked by the blacks, and it was funny to watch it collapse in real time in such short order. But then they just spam us. We're just constantly being spammed. It's like if you check your email and there's nothing in there but spam. It's just all these emails starting off with hello dear or something. It's just all this spam, and we get spammed with these narratives. And like that one, it came along, it was stupid, and it just disappears. But doesn't matter, everybody forgets it in short order because they're busy spamming us with the next narrative. Now we're talking about, and in my opinion, I always lump Russia and China together, because in my opinion, and I'm like an expert, but I am pretty good at common sense and figuring things out. I don't believe you have a scenario where the U.S. gets into a conflict with Russia or China, because I think, in my opinion, either one of these nations, if you're Putin and you're sitting there and the U.S. manages to bumble its way into a conflict with China, you're going to be sitting there going, well, you know, I either throw in, I mean, you know that conflict with the U.S. is inevitable one way or the other. I mean, it's inevitable. That's not, you know, everybody's dancing around. And if you're Putin and you look and they get into a conflict with China, you're going to say, well, conflict with the U.S. is inevitable. I have a better chance of wrapping this up quickly in victory if we go ahead and throw our cards in with China now. And so I don't see a scenario where you're talking about Russia or China. And I see people say all the time, Russia or China. But I think in any context, you're talking about a conflict with Russia and China. Now, I don't think the U.S. can win a conflict with either one by themselves, but both together, it's going to be a humiliating defeat and probably in fairly short order. But before we get off into some of the whys and wheres of that, I mean, what do you think? You think there's a scenario where the U.S. could actually manage to keep one side out while they attack one side individually?
Most likely not. In fact, I would say definitely not. Because, yeah, the, you know, as I stated with the whole public opinion of how other nations think of the U.S., the whole world doesn't like the U.S., and they see the U.S. as the number one threat to world peace and just the world in general. So not only is it going to be Russia and China, it's also going to be, you got Iran, you got North Korea, you got Pakistan, you got, you know, all these other nations that are going to be part of the Belt and Road Initiative soon. They're all going to gang up together. They're going to say, you know what, we've had enough of the U.S. empire always starting wars, always, troublemaking and destabilizing nations. We've had enough of the U.S. Why don't we all team up together? This is our common goal. Our number one enemy is the United States of America. Let's come together and let's beat down this monster once and for all. And I think we're going to see something like that where, Russia and China lead the entire world in a struggle against American imperialism, American hegemony. And that would be good for Americans from within, too, because then we would finally be free from the yoke of global homo federal tyranny from within.
Well, I think it's all kind of, too, on the timeline. And people understand, I think people need to understand that the regime is up against the clock. They don't have forever to implement their agenda. And that's why we're seeing from some of these frantic actions, because to me, from my point of view, these look like acts of desperation, because people get this defeatist mindset, like everything goes the way of the regime, everything goes the way of liberalism, it's inevitable. And part of that is because of the way this staged political system we have works. The Republicans pretend to be in opposition, but at the end of the day, the Democrats always get what they want. And so that drills into people's mind the sense of inevitability, that the shit libs, I like that term because, it so well applies, but like the left is always going to get what they want. It's always inevitable that they're going to win. And, people get this mindset like, that's the case, but it's not. They're up against the clock. They have a limited amount of time to implement this agenda. They're getting weaker every day, and they're up against the clock because the dollar is going to collapse. That is going to happen. All of these things are doing, trying to create all these trillions of dollars. They're just trying to keep this thing going long enough till they can implement their one world wet dream government. But they're up against the clock, and every day China and Russia are getting stronger, and the U.S. is getting weaker. If the dollar collapses before they bumble off into war, then we probably won't see a conflict. But right now, you do. You got this definite chance of conflict, and no, it won't end. It won't end well. I was reading an article recently, and it was in the Global Times, which is like China's version of RT. And by the way, Cato, they need to hire you to like edit some of their articles, because the way they're written, it's kind of like, guys, I mean, you're supposed to be aiming this towards like, an American or a Western audience. So they're reading your point of view, and it reads, I don't mean this. I don't bring people on the show to be insulting, but it reads so Chinese, it's just like, yeah, I mean, it does. It reads, it's like, guys, hire Cato. He can help you with this. But I was reading an article in the Global Times, and they were actually going through and naming all these incidents that I didn't realize. And I know Dr. Johnson here at Radio Albion has touched on it from time to time, but all of these different incidents where U.S. ships have just crashed into, it's like the U.S. Navy has become a kamikaze fleet. If you're running a cargo, if you're a captain of a cargo freighter and you see a U.S. ship out there, you got to be wondering if they're just going to kamikaze into your ass. You're just out there minding your own business. You got your shipping containers, you're all stacked up there. You're minding your own business. You're going down the shipping lane, and just at random, blam, you're going to get hit by U.S. destroyer just ramming into you. But they did. They listed off all these incidents. I didn't realize there were that many of these ships, these U.S. warships, that can't even navigate through waters. They just crash into other ships. And, I mean, these are serious. It's not like, a fender bender. Like 10, 12 people die in these incidents. But we don't, of course, hear about them because that flies in the face of the narrative of the all-powerful U.S. military. But, I mean, people say, well, the U.S.'s Navy is much bigger than Russia and China's put together. Yeah, and they're crashing into cargo ships. It's a kamikaze Navy. But I was reading of all these incidents where they can't navigate. They crash into other ships. And I'm thinking, any real conflict with Russia or China, but especially China, would have to somehow be launched. Basically the Navy, the U.S. Navy would be the base of operations, but they're busy crashing into cargo ships. I don't think that ends well. In other words, you can have all of the ships, you can have all the whiz-bang technology that you think you have, But at the end of the day, you got to have human capital. You got to have people. You got to have people that know how to operate the ship in a competent manner. Before I hand it back off to you, another thing I read here recently, and you probably remembered here, it's been a year or so back in San Diego, a Navy ship caught on fire and the thing basically burned. You can't say burned to the ground because it's a ship floating in the water. Burned to the seafloor. They had to scrap the ship, totaled this multi-billion-dollar ship. And it winds up, one of the sailors set the thing on fire on purpose, but they said the reason it burned down, get this now, it's a ship. If you're in a ship and you're in conflict, you're going to be getting hit with high explosive rounds, which means the ship is going to catch on fire. They have systems in place. And that was one of the puzzling things when this happened. They're like, we have all these systems in place because it's a ship. You're going to get in a Navy battle. It is going to catch on fire, which is like the number one thing you're worried about on a ship, besides maybe hypersonic missiles. But they had a fire suppression system. Why wasn't it used? Well, it turned out nobody on the ship was competent enough to operate the fire suppression equipment system. Well, and it winds up, you're thinking, well, it must have been complicated. No, they said it amounted to a button. There was a big red button, and you push that button, and no one on the ship was competent enough to go, hey, we've got a fire. Someone on the bridge pushed the freaking button. Nobody was smart enough to do that. No one understood it. No one understood how the system worked. No one even, they said the bottom didn't even know what the big red button was for that probably said fire on it. You know, don't hit the fire button, whatever you do. But the point is, you've got ships crashing into cargo ships. You got a ship that catches on fire, and nobody on board is got the brains and intelligence and competence to turn on the freaking fire extinguishers. And yet we're going to wander off into a conflict with Russia and China. When we say the U.S. won't win a conflict with these entities, we're not just America bashing. It's not what we're doing. We're not just, you know, rah-rah these other countries. We're just stating fact. When you look at these things, when you don't have people on a ship that's supposed to be ready at any time to sail off into war, get spammed with HE rounds and catch on fire, and there's nobody on board smart enough to hit the fire extinguisher button, I think you've got a problem. It's a problem. Not just in manufacturing, you put all these things that we've already touched on, not just in manufacturing capability, not just in the fact that you get parts from what you do build from places like China, but the fact of this lack of human capital. You don't have anybody smart enough to know how to operate the fire suppression system. I'm going to go out on a limb here and say that if you wandered on to any random Chinese warship and you said, hey there, you know, I don't know. I'm not going to say a good China name, Wenling or whatever the hell. What do you do if there's a fire breaks out? They're not going to look at you and go, I don't know. No, they're going to be like, oh, you push this button right here. It puts fire out. You know, I just this lack of human capital is something I think also that gets way overlooked.
Yeah, exactly. You go onto a ship. Yeah, they're not going to say, oh, 我不知道. That's Chinese are saying, I don't know. No, they're gonna, yeah, they're China's a meritocracy. They're gonna hire the best people. Otherwise, they wouldn't be hired. They would be gone right away if they weren't capable. But yeah, I mean that's the thing. And this whole myth of U.S. military supremacy. I mean, this goes back for over 100 years. You know, ever since 1865, because the way I view it is that 1865, that's when the American Empire started. Was in 1865 after the war between the states, where the federal government crushed the southern nation. But ever since then, all the wars that the U.S. has been involved in, okay, we start. Okay, you look at the Spanish-American War. Okay, the U.S. Okay, home turf advantage because I mean, you know, Cuba's right in America's backyard, and how far away is Spain? So you have that. But you look at World War One, for example. Yeah, the U.S. entered. In the last minute, the very last minute of World War One, when all the European powers had already exhausted themselves, the U.S. finally enter in the very last minute when they've been out the whole time, and they should have stayed out completely. But the point is, they came in the very last minute when all of Europe has exhausted itself, and then they claim that oh yeah, victory. You look at World War Two, the vast majority of the fighting, 80 to 90% of the fighting was on the Eastern Front, was the Soviet Union. Was the Red Army. It was really a battle between National Socialism and Bolshevism. And the U.S. entered, you know, you look at the combined troops death toll between the casualties between the U.S. and British troops. It was only like several hundred thousand. You look at the Soviet casualties, the Red Army casualties, you know, it was like 30 million. of course, a lot of that was because of the Bolshevik commissars in the back shooting their own, executing their own men who would retreat. But nonetheless, though, I mean, the bulk of the fighting was on the Eastern Front. I mean, the U.S. and the British were just supporting the Soviets, not the other way around. So that's a myth there. You look at Korea and Vietnam, well, the U.S. lost both of them. I mean, you know, we talked about Korea earlier, how, yeah, the Chinese were able to push the U.S. all the way back, and how in Vietnam, well, I mean, you know, obviously the U.S. Cheated a lot, you know, with, like, Agent Orange and all this military technology, but at the end, they still lost. They still lost to the Viet Cong at the end. You know, and then most recently, you look at Afghanistan, you look how that went, what a blunder that was. So, yeah, the U.S. militarily is not superior. It's just a myth. And the only reason why they've been able to claim that is because throughout history, they're generally the ones that either they come in at the very last minute and, you know, they have the least amount of casualties usually, or the nations they're fighting are like really tiny third world nations, which they still lose against.
Well, yeah, and you know, America, like, well, yeah, but we whipped Japan. Well, yeah, it took, what, 4 or 5 years, you know, like 4+ years to do it, and it's an island nation, you know, with, like, basically no natural resources. I think something else that we do to point out as we talk, as we stay on this topic, though, and we're talking about the, you know, the lack of human capital, and I think that at the end of the day, you can have whiz-bang technology and all of that, but you're always, your most important asset is going to be your human capital, the people you have operating it. And it's like the people running this thing are high on their own supply, you know. And the one thing, you look at the stark difference, say with China, and what do they have lack that we do have? And that word is diversity. If you look at the Chinese military, it is Chinese. That is it. There, you're not going to find these random other people on their ships, in their military. It is all Chinese. So you have this ethnically homogenous people versus this U.S. thing, which we've got plenty of diversity. And really, I'm not one to beat around the bush. You look at the lack of human capital. Well, why is that? Well, because the people who are competent, they spend all of their time calling them domestic terrorists and excluding them. And they've put all of this diversity, whether it's racial minorities or whether it's women. Now we're doing the whole tranny thing. And this is what we've got in our military. It's like the people running this. It'd be one thing if they pushed it on the domestic side, but like, well, we need to keep the military where it functions. So let's find a way to funnel as many white people in there and keep them running it as they can. It's like they're high on their own supply. And now they're believing the diversity is our strength narrative. And they've actually applied that to the military. They've actually applied that to the military. So you have the diversity military versus the racially homogenous military. Now we see how that turned out. I mean, you look at Afghanistan, you talked about Vietnam, it was the same sort of thing. The strength of a united, homogenous people. I mean, Afghanistan, everybody knew in Afghanistan, at some point in time, the U.S. is going to leave. And the Taliban will take back over, because that's the natural order of things. You have basically a racially homogenous group in the Taliban, you know, who has a sense of inevitability, a sense of solidarity in their victory. And it comes about. And you have the U.S., which could dwarf them economically. They could throw untold amounts of money into this. But at the end of the day, they get beat by a bunch of desert dwellers with old AK-47s. You know, well, why is that? Because we have the diversity. We have all this money and we have the diversity. But they have like a homogenous. I really think that a people who can rally around their ethnocentric place, you have a homogenous people and they can come together, they're always going to be stronger, regardless of what kind of numbers you can put on the table, what kind of facts and figures. They're always going to be starting from a stronger position. The more diverse, this notion that diversity is our strength is utter nonsense. The more diverse your forces are, the more division you're going to have, the more conflicts you're going to have, the more problems you're going to have, because there isn't a shared sense of identity. And there is no shared sense of identity in the West today.
Yeah, especially now when they've injected now the tranny ogres, degenerates, into the force. Yeah, that makes it even stronger now with all these tranny degenerate ogres.
There be ogres in these waters. No, it is. And again, it's why is this important? Because this will affect all of us. I mean, like I always say, we're stuck in the clown car. We're not behind the wheel. We're not. We're basically like stuck in this bus that is careening off the cliff. We're off the cliff. We're just waiting to crash to the bottom and see who crawls out of the wreckage once we get there. But it is going to affect us. That's why it matters. You know, we talk about this thing and you might be listening to the show and be like, well, why do I care about any of this? Because believe it or not, this will affect you. It's affecting you now. These actions they're taking, this direction they're going in, it will affect you. It is important. And as I talked about, as we're getting ready to kind of wrap up here, but as I talked about at the first part of the show, they're currently ginning up. You know the cycles and the history. Before the conflict, they start ginning up. Maybe this is another reason why the ridiculous anti-Asian hate thing narrative went away. They're starting to really gin up this propaganda, the war propaganda, especially with China. Little less so, but still with Russia as well. And, you know, that's kind of one of those red flags, that the direction they're going in with this. And at the end of the day, it will affect you. It will affect us. If a conflict is to break out, if you have children that are like of military age, you dang well should have your hackles up. You should dang well be worried about this, because it is, I mean, it's not going to go in a good direction, and it's not going to end well, I don't think, for the U.S.
Yeah, and it certainly doesn't help, though, when you got these boomer conservatives going on about, oh, yeah, hell yeah, China's the problem, right? Hey, we got to go after China. It does not, yeah, that doesn't help one bit. And you know, I read it best somewhere, where here's how they say it. They say, if you have one side that's aggressively promoting war with China or with a nation, and then you have the other side that's accusing that one side of not of being a puppet of that same nation, you've effectively created a recipe for war. And that's exactly what we're seeing here. We have the by far the most aggressive administration against China. And then you got the other side calling them, oh yeah, they're owned by the CCP. It's the most illogical thing I've ever seen in my life.
Oh, it is. It's utter nonsensical. I've had people hit me with that line, IRL, you know, or the Chinese, they control all the Biden, the Chinese, they control all our politicians. And I have, yes, I have IRL looked at these people and said, yeah, you know, the most powerful lobby in America is you know, CHIPAC, you know, like a play on APAC, and you get this blank look, you know, what do you mean? You know, I mean, it's so in your face, you know, I mean, come on now, you know, no politician is going to the Great Wall of China and putting the little hat on and bowing down every time they want to run for office. You don't have politicians making public appearances at an event held by the China lobby talking about, no matter what happens to America, we'll always be sure that China gets their billions of dollars. You know, I mean, to come up with these narratives, and I hate it, they come up with these narratives, then, you know, all the politicians are owned by China. And it is. It's stupid in your face. Like you say, I mean, you know, they're supposedly owned by China, but at the same time, they're trying to, like, gin up a war with China. It's like this cognitive dissonance, especially, like you say, in like, the boomer population. And I try to be understanding. I try to say they don't know any better. But, yeah, it is. It's beyond frustrating, isn't it?
Oh yeah, it's just, yeah. I mean, you definitely have a lot more patience for them than I do, because it's. I mean, especially and here's the thing too, if I ever come out and I say that no, mainland China is not bad. It's not what it's not what you boomers think it is. It's actually doing really good. They'll in a heartbeat they'll call me a CCP pie. Go back to China, you evil Chinaman, or you CCP, whatever. To which I just say, well, I wish I could. It's easier said than done. But the thing is, yeah, they'll call me a CCP spy, just like they'll call you a white supremacist for standing up for saying, hey, I don't think that Europeans should be demographically replaced in their own countries. Oh, you're an evil white supremacist. I don't think that the mainland China is that bad. In fact, they're doing very well. Oh, you're a CCP spy. It's the same logic. It's the same illogic. And to which I could say, on the question of being a CCP spy, well, it'd be nice if they paid me to. It'd be nice if they paid me for what I do.
Yeah. The pay rate in the truth-telling community isn't nearly compared to the pay rate apparently in the shilling community, because the shills, they seem to get these, you know, big gigs, you know, and they suddenly just pop up and they've got these platforms, $1 million budgets. Meanwhile, over here in the truth telling community, we're just doing what we can. Yeah, no, I really sympathize with your position. I understand what you're saying. You know, I mean, you pipe up and lay these truth bombs on, they're looking at you sideways. I knew I couldn't trust you. You just a Chinaman, you know, you did America. You know, and you know, like I referenced the anti Asian hate hoax crap that they threw up earlier and how that narrative went away. And, you know, if a conflict does break out, you know, all that'll go out the window. You think about the Japanese that were putting internment camps in World War II. If you think this government wouldn't throw the anti-Asia hate thing out the window and start rounding anybody that looked remotely Chinese and putting them in a camp, then, you know, I think a person would be deluded. The good news is, see, we're all going to be in camps. See, maybe they'll integrate the camps. You can hang out with me. You know, I've already kind of been lining up future cellmates for when we go in the camp, whether it's for, you know, refusing the COVID vaccine or speaking to the truth, you know, as far as the system works, or perhaps you just look too much like a CCP spy. Yeah, they're going to have some big camps because they're adding lists all the time of people that are going into the camp. So as we get ready to wrap up, any final thoughts on going to the camp there, Cato? I mean, do you want top bunk? Do you want bottom bunk? Or do you have a preference? You know, I mean, I want a cellmate that's got good, you know, good hygiene. I don't want to be stuck in a cell with a slob, anything like that. But yeah, as we wrap up, any final thoughts for us?
Well, all I could say is, if they try to put us all in camps, because that seems like what they want to do, they want to put half the dissidents in camps. Well, the thing is, there's limited space. Space is not unlimited. And if they put us all in camps, well, guess what? Those camps are eventually going to explode and everyone's going to come out.
Yeah, it's like the whole country is going to become a camp. I remember years ago, somebody came by, and this was back when, you know, I had a regular job, and this guy came by doing like a political polling, and this was back way before Trump. And he was talking about, you know, do you support the idea of immigration reform as long as there's a wall on the border? And I told him no, and they said, well, why is that? And I said, because I get the feeling that at some point in time, and I didn't realize at the time how prophetic I was being, because I was not nearly aware of these subjects as I am now, but I was being prophetic whether I realized it or not. I told him, I said, I have this feeling that at some point in time, that wall is going to be used to keep us in, not to keep the other people out. That's right. We're all stuck in this clown car together, and we've all got to figure out a way to come out on the other side. So we're going to wrap up on that note. Thank you once again. I'm glad you could join us, Cato, and I hope people got something out of the conversation. Like I said, I don't do these shows like this. It's like once in a blue moon I do a show like this, but it is. It's always fun to sit down and have a conversation, and it always is difficult for people to come on like this because I don't do show notes. We were talking about this before we started, and I don't do show notes. It always puts people kind of, you know, they're like, well, what are we going to talk about? It's like, I don't know, whatever comes to mind. And people are like, what the hell are we doing? What have I wandered off into? So, you know, it's a merciful thing that I don't do these very often. But I always think these kind of just open conversation type of format, it works well for me. And I think at the end of the day, it works well all in all. I like the outcome. So thank you once again, Cato, for joining us. And everybody, where can everybody catch you on Mondays?
So it's on Republic Broadcasting Network, RBN, Mondays at Dr. Patrick Slattery. His show goes out every day on 1 p.m. Central, 2 p.m. Central, 3 p.m. Eastern time. And I'm on Mondays at 2 p.m. Central, 3 p.m. Eastern time. So republicbroadcastingnetwork.org, republicbroadcastingnetwork.org. Go to the archives, look for Dr. Patrick Slattery's name, and you can gain access to all of his shows. And he has a description under each of the shows. So that's how you can listen.
Yeah, good deal. Everybody can get the hot takes from the inner workings of the CCP spy network. No, we're just kidding. No, we're not really. Good stuff. And I hope everybody will check it out. And again, I thank you for joining us here today. We're going to back on out of here. And who knows, folks, who knows how long it'll be before you get another hijacked Albion Insight show with yours truly someday. If it's worthy of the time and effort, you'll see us here again. But we're going to back on out of here. Thank you again for joining us. And we'll see you next time here at Radio Albion.